Blog Talk Radio.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, just bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your ship bare. See how I leave with every piece of you. Don't underestimate the things that I will do. There's a fire starting in my heart. You cheating a fever, and it's bringing me out the dark. The scars of your love remind me of us. They keep me thinking if we almost had it all. The scars of your love, they leave me breathless. I can't get feeling we could have had it all.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Kitchen Politics 123 Radio Show. I'm David Franklin in New Mexico.
Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone is okay tonight.
Yes, and this is Kitchen Politics 123 Radio Show, and tonight's title, Season 3, Episode 16. We'll have an interview with Rachel Murphy-Azara. She is the Executive Director and Co-Founder of Democrats Work for America. She'll be on 40 minutes past the hour at 7:40. A lot of things going on in the country. Today was the January 6th final public hearings, and they've offered the Justice Department, they offered them the suggestions on how to pursue Donald Trump to make him be accountable for his actions, and that mob, that insurrectionist crowd, refer them for prosecution, and hopefully the Justice Department takes it up and, prosecute Donald Trump and those responsible for what happened on January 6th. So what we start with, Lori?
Well, yes, I watched today the hearing, and I agree with you. Donald Trump and his minions all need to go to prison. They need, I feel like they need to do it sooner than later, because once the House takes over, they're going to try to muddy everything up, and they're going to try to, throw flames into the fire, and make things even worse in this country. Also, there are four senators that need to be subpoenaed and be accountable for their actions as well. We have Kevin McCarthy, we have Jim Jordan, we have Scott Perry, and we have Andy Biggs. And, they were all referred to the Ethics Committee for the failure to comply with the subpoena. If they had nothing to hide, why did they not comply? I mean, that within itself tells a tale. So I'm looking forward to a lot of answers to a lot of questions and some actual indictment very soon.
Yes. How dare people that sit in Congress, when they get a subpoena, don't show up to testify?
Yeah.
That's not right. If it was any regular person, they'd be thrown in jail for what they did.
Yes, absolutely correct. And, they are not to be held at higher standards. I mean, they were elected by the people. They work for the people. They get paid by the people. And they have absolutely no business, ignoring a subpoena. Mm-hmm. If they, in February when they come in, if they think they're going to subpoena people and then they have to show up, that's hysterical, isn't it? Even think about it.
Yeah, it is hysterical.
Something has to come of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Because nobody is bigger than the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America. Nixon wasn't. No president, no regular citizens of the United States is above the law. And hopefully good sense will prevail and Justice Department do what they have to do to, you know, put this man in prison for what he did. Because the first time in United States history this ever happened, where a former president who's been voted out of office tried to take power, you know, through violent means. People died.
Yeah.
You know, he got impeached twice. And, you know, it's just a disgrace. We're supposed to be the beacon of democracy and hope for the world. We'll have someone like Donald Trump doing what he did, and the Republicans backing him. I mean, they created this monster. He announced the idea that he's running for president. And, you know, I don't think he'll get anywhere, because slowly but surely the establishment is turning their back on him. And hopefully the MAGA support will wane down, because he has a challenger in the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, you know, which is no better. He's no better, but Republicans have nothing better to offer. So hopefully Joe Biden stick to his guns. Democrats support him across the country. And come 2024, you know, we'll teach him a political lesson.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. And, you know, it can't be stressed enough. No one is above the law. Absolutely no one. And if, you know, if Donald J. Trump, the orange monster, thinks he's above the law, he's got something else coming. Because people of this country, truly, the ones that, you know, can think for themselves and really love this country and for the right things, want justice. And there will be no justice, there will be no peace unless he goes to prison for what he did. And that's, you know, that's the way it has to be. That's the way it has to be.
Exactly. You know, it's disgraceful that Republicans, you know, created this monster, and none of them have the testicular fortitude nor spine to stand up to him. Only Congresswoman Cheney and Raffensperger from Illinois, you know, you know, stood up to him as Republicans on that committee. So, you know, things falling into place, and hopefully Trump will go into prison where he belongs. Okay, so like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/kitchenpolitics123. Thanks for sharing across social media. We're here every Monday and every Thursday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 p.m. Mountain Time. You know, so we're getting a lot of traction on the Facebook page. We're grateful for that. People commenting, people sharing, and people liking. And the show picking up steam as well. And we look forward to speaking with Rachel Murphy Azara, who's doing outstanding work in Missouri with her 527 grassroots political group, Democrats Work for America. The number to call, 515-605-9802. Say your first name and where you're calling from. And please, please turn off the TV. No background noise, or you'll be put on hold or cut off. And be respectful to our guests, because, you know, we're not going to tolerate any, you know, shouting over the guests. We're not going to tolerate any disrespect to you, Lori, nor the guests. You know, so, you know, let's just have fun, and let's hope that, you know, people listening can learn something from this and take away a lot of good things from this interview tonight. You know, we're looking forward to the calls, and already 7 calls lined up. But, you know, we just, you know, yeah, so we're going to have a kick-ass show tonight. And learn about Missouri politics and what Democrats Work for America doing across the country.
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear what Rachel has to say, what the plans are for 2024. We have to start now in planning, you know, making sure we have a clear path to win in 2024, hands down. That's it. So let's start now. Be lazy. We can't start, you know, any year from now. We have to start now.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yes.
For sure.
Okay, so did you hear about that Republican politician who lied on his application when he was running for political office in Congressional District 3? He's originally from Brazil, and he made up this tale about, you know, being, you know, the American dream. But yet still, his, he is in trouble from his native Brazil. because the person he worked for, he stole a checkbook and wrote bad checks.
Yep.
And it's in District 3, New York, Congressional District 3, New York, where it flipped from Democrat to Republican because an incumbent congressman decided to run against Governor Hochul in New York. And it backfired on him, so, you know, we'll have a Republican in that seat. All right, so let's get the show on the road. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Before I introduce Rachel,
I was just going to say it's disgraceful that, you know, we have candidates that no one knows, you know, their background. They don't research their background deep enough. And, you know, he would have never gotten elected. So, yeah, it's crazy times. But let's get going. I'm excited about Rachel coming on the show.
Yes. We're pleased to have Rachel Murphy-Zahra, co-founder and executive director for Democrats Work for America, on the show tonight. Hello, Rachel. Welcome to Kitchen Politics 123.
Hello. Really glad to be here.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited about our conversation today.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your organization and how you started, you know, what your goals are? Just a little bit of, you know, just tell us about yourself.
Okay. Well, for myself, personally, let's see. I have a degree in anthropology and philosophy, but then I ended up, because you don't do a lot with a degree in that right out of the gate, you know. So I ended up having self-taught myself web page design and things like that, and that was actually how I made a living for a lot of years. But then I was working doing strategic research development at a university and sort of gotten more into strategic planning. And let's see, how I sort of came to be where I am now is that after I had children, and I've always been, you know, pretty politically active, you know, pretty much in things like that. So I was certainly doing grassroots work and things. And then so many of us had been working together and were frustrated with the way things were going. And then, of course, when Trump was elected, you know, it was a bit of a shock that he was elected. But it was also a moment where we had to reflect and say, hey, we've been losing a lot of seats for a long time, you know. And we all, you know, we got together and we thought, there are things that are missing, you know, that are, there are reasons why we've been losing. Part of it was there were huge gaps in the party infrastructure, which the Republicans had done a much better job of sort of keeping all of that in place in between elections and then just sort of forming up candidates up through that. They kept their community better year-round and in communication. And I think maybe because their party's not quite as big of a tent, you know, maybe it's a little easier for them to corral. But we really saw a lack of strategy happening on the ground. And we came to the idea that, you know what, as grassroots activists, in a lot of ways, we're better positioned to see where those gaps are and how we can fill them. Better than perhaps some of the, you know, the party people themselves. And that was sort of the premise that we came into forming the organization with. And so we formed the Democrats Work for America, which there are a lot of grassroots groups out there, but what makes us different is we are very focused on early identification of winnable candidates, early support, and we identify those candidates through local input with activists that we have on the ground in these communities. We choose a candidate based on a pretty rigorous assessment that we believe can win the general. And we keep those relationships in place with activists and with community groups, you know, like sometimes district level groups, things like that, year round, so that we have those voter, those sort of voter relationships in place, and they we build up trust with them, you know, and they're they say they believe us when we tell them, hey, this is a candidate who can win. This is somebody who it's worth to put your resources behind, because there are so many people taking action in so many different directions. It's not great for maximizing wins, which is kind of what we discovered, is that we really want to leverage the limited resources that there are in a very strategic fashion.
Wonderful.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
I love all that. I just wanted to say one thing. I agree with everything that you said, you know, about the big tent and the messaging. And I think you, I think your organization is spot on with the goals, because we've been talking about this for a long time, haven't we, David, that their messaging and all of that, they're kind of scattered. And I'm happy to hear that we're not the only ones that think like that, because I've been saying it for a long time, you know.
It really is a problem a lot of times, particularly with messaging. And you know, some of that does just, you know, as you said, go to there being a big tent, you know. And, you know, certainly the idea of a 50-state strategy has, you know, been around, you know, but that we really have to look at, you know, come to terms with what that means, especially in this sort of age of social media and things like that, is that if you let all the candidates get defined by sort of like the loudest progressive voices, that messaging is just simply not going to work in certain places, you know.
You're right.
And that's something that, you know, like it or not, you have to come to terms with, you know, that it's not, the audiences are not the same. And, you know, not all Democrats look the same, and not all winnable candidates look the same. It just depends on where you are.
Yeah, so Rachel, tell me, in this toxic era of politics, are we headed for violence, and is it preferred over voting? Because as we see in North Carolina, the grid was messed with, and we'll see January 6th what happened in 2021. When Republicans and right-wingers don't get their own way, you know, it, when it comes to that, where, you know, violence is preferred over voting, you think?
You know, I don't think that violence is preferred over voting for most of the population. That said, I think that there are pockets, you know, groups of people that have radicalized. I mean, I don't think that there's much doubt of that. I mean, we see that all the time. And that's something that is very concerning, because unfortunately, the more actions that a potentially violent group takes, the more that eggs on a possible retaliatory action, which is sort of the last thing that you want to have happen. And I mean, it's worth exploring, you know, that they're, you know, I suppose that, you know, if people are feeling that that action isn't happening fast enough, I don't know that the blame of that necessarily always falls on politicians themselves, but also in sort of that, the messaging again to people, is that there isn't a quick fix, you know? There isn't a magic wand that somebody is going to wave that's going to make exactly what you want to happen happen. This, you know, we have an electoral process. It happens by votes. And but I fear the violence. I mean, I fear it because we're saying that the voting matters and the voting is what matters, but you have an entire party that has been centered on talking about you know, voting not mattering, that elections are rigged, that it's no longer useful. And that is incredibly inflammatory to the people that already have a tendency towards violence.
Yes.
And I think the best thing that we can do, you know, is to keep turning out that vote and keep educating voters and keep getting people involved so that they feel like the civic process is working for them. Because the alternative, I mean, the alternative is utter chaos, you know, and the end of democracy, essentially.
Yeah, you better believe it. That's the scary part right there, the end of democracy. You know, people just don't understand, you know, what, you know, part of the problem I feel is maybe we're spoiled in this country and we've always been a democracy, you know, and basically people have taken it for granted and they really don't understand, you know, what we have here in this country, you know, the fairness of a democracy. And that's kind of a shame, you know.
You know, Laurie, I think that you're actually very right. I've thought about this before myself, that I think in America, people really sort of suffer from this idea that certain things simply can't happen here, you know, where they think they've always had democracy, and so they don't necessarily realize how precious it is, and the fact that it can be overthrown, and it can be corrupted, you know, and we can certainly point to other places where that's happened, you know, has happened, but people still think that somehow we have some sort of magic beans that'll stop it from happening to us.
Yeah.
But in reality, you know, if we don't take part in the civic process and we don't pay attention, it certainly can happen.
Absolutely can.
My
next question is, would you have something to say, David?
Oh, yes. We'll have a couple callers online, and I'm going to let a couple in first. Thank you so much for being patient and holding on. Welcome to Kitchen Politics 123. What's your name and where are you calling from? And do you have a question for our guest, Rich or Murphy Zara, tonight?
Elaine from Michigan. No questions, just listening.
Okay,
hi,
no
Elaine.
Problem, no problem.
Hi.
Pianke, welcome to Kitchen Politics 123. What's cooking today? Hello, Carla, you're
nothing's
online.
Cooking. Nothing's cooking, David. This is Kelly from Michigan, and I'm listening. I want to hear all about the grassroots program because here in Michigan, we would like to see some good changes to the Jackson County area, just like Lori wants to see in her area as well.
Yeah. Absolutely, in my area, yes.
My
area is very red.
Yeah.
We need help.
So go ahead. Lori, go ahead with your question for our guest.
Okay. What are your thoughts on Trump threatening Jack Smith and his family with violence?
Well, I can't say that I'm shocked by it. I mean, I should be. But I'm not, because this has been a, you know, modus operandi that has worked for Trump, right? I mean, he's pretty much anybody who comes up against him, he immediately, you know, starts a campaign of hate against and distrust against, and he gets his base to feel negatively, no matter what their background, no matter how much of a stellar record they have, no matter what's happened. I mean, there's nobody they won't turn against in that sense. Now, I think what makes it a little bit worse, though, is that particularly, you know, post January 6th, and, you know, is that, and, you know, post, like, the attack on Gretchen Whitmer and things like that, is that, you know, there's a growing fear that it becomes more than rhetoric, you know? And when you start to have the legal process being stymied under potential fear for somebody's safety. I mean, it doesn't get any more severe than that as far as the operation of our country. I mean, we can't have justice compromised that way. I think that it's very sad that not every single Republican doesn't stand up and speak out against this kind of thing. And honestly, I think that the media should always be putting, you know, Republican politicians' feet to the fire here and asking point blank to make a statement. Every time Trump makes, you know, one of these unhinged statements about somebody, they should be asking the senators and the members of Congress, what do you think about this? And get them on record. Don't let them slide.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
All right, my question, my next question. In some quarters, some are saying that President Joe Biden is too old to run again in 2024. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, is 86 years old and was elected to serve another 6 years in the U.S. Senate. Do you think age should be a factor when running for federal office on any level, whether senator, governor, president? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think Grassley really exemplifies the upper end here, you know. I think that it's, you know, it's absurd, really. I mean, at that point, I mean,
I agree with that.
You know, I think, see, this is the thing, is that I do think it's better overall to not have candidates that are too old, you know, and especially if this comes down to Biden and Trump, which, you know, I'm sort of hoping that it is Trump, but, you know, does, it's like it, you know, I know that, for example, my children, who are both, you know, young teenagers, you know, they were both like, it bothers them. You know, they're like, I was just hoping we'd get somebody younger in. I was just hoping that. And the thing with Joe Biden is that we needed that sort of experience and that steady hand.
We did.
And we needed somebody that instilled trust in people. So, you know, and I'm not inclined to say I don't think he should run again because you lose the incumbent advantage if he doesn't. And that's pretty risky. You know, that is pretty risky. That said, it is less than ideal. And, you know, I do think a lot of people voted for him thinking it would be a single term, that it would be sort of a transitory situation. So I guess I don't have a black and white answer for you on that. I think there should be an upper edge, you know what I mean? That I feel like it's kind of a shame we have to spell it out, you know? I feel like there reaches a certain point and, like, somebody's good sense steps in, you know, like a person like Grassley, you know, like that it's probably not a good idea to go for a six-year term when you're 86 years old, you know?
I mean, that makes no, he doesn't care. I'm sure he doesn't care. He probably, you know, who knows if he shows up, you know, it's just, you know, gets paid and he probably doesn't care.
That if he were to pass away during his term, that it would be his governor that would, you know, replace him for the time being, which would keep the seat, you know, safely red, although I don't think the seat's really in danger of not being red right now, but, you know, that's another thing. I mean, that probably plays into the decision.
Yeah, probably. And I think you're right. I think the young people want a younger representation. And I also think Joe Biden is kind of, his thinking is not old-fashioned. I feel that. I kind of feel that, you know, that
you
he
know,
does
I
understand.
Agree. I agree. I don't think he's particularly old-fashioned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's better aware of, you know, better aware of current issues that,
mm-hmm.
than a lot of, you know, people in, of his own peers, a lot of peers of his that I know, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think sometimes he might come off a little old, you know, a little old fashioned to the younger people, but then
mm-hmm.
I come
mm-hmm.
off old fashioned to the younger people too. So
absolutely.
We do.
Yeah.
You know, that's something we're all sort of always up
yeah.
against.
Yep. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I do think that we, you know, this next generation that is coming, you know, and they're huge. I think that maybe they need to start thinking about younger candidates and, you know, going, you know, a little bit more in that direction, and they will do well. They will do well for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They did. And, you know, I actually thought that party leadership, you know,
mm-hmm.
made a really sort of excellent and graceful showing of that, was sort of having the changing of the guard, you know,
yes.
of the
mm-hmm.
top three leadership positions, you know, and
yes.
that was something that Nancy said that she was going to do, and she did do it,
mm-hmm.
you know, of saying it's time for a newer generation to come in. And I thought that that was a really good start. You know,
yeah, Nancy Pelosi, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Yes.
Do you have anything else? David?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, yes, man. I was just going to say that, you know, term limits is a thing when 2010, when Republicans came into power in the House of Representatives with that Senate Contract
mm-hmm.
America by Newt Gingrich. One of the 10 things that was on a list is term limits. Do
mm-hmm.
you think term limits should be a thing on federal level, or, you know, is up to the people to vote out politicians, where they're a long time, like Chuck Grassley and whomever else?
Right. You know, that is another that's a very interesting topic to explore, because
mm-hmm.
there's pros and cons, you know, to it. I think that on a very personal level, you know, just in my own mind, I think term limits make some sense. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
I think you can
mm-hmm.
be in a position too long, and it just makes sense to sort of have somebody else come in. Now, of course, from a purely partisan level, you know, there are people that know the power of the incumbency. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's a very real thing. And they simply don't want to risk losing the seat. You know, and so
mm-hmm.
I can certainly see that argument. I think it's a tougher issue in the Senate than in the House, because just in general,
mm-hmm.
for the most part, there's a lot of turnover in the House, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we do get people that, like I said, they just keep sort of riding that incumbency all the way through. You know, people
yeah.
will get close
mm-hmm.
to them, but they still just keep staying there and staying there and staying
mm-hmm.
there. If
yeah.
we're talking about a purely Democratic issue, though, it is the people voting them out, you know, and I guess it's up to
yeah.
the other campaigns to shake that up. You know, it's just,
mm-hmm.
it is difficult.
Yeah, you're right about that.
I mean, like, I'm thinking
mm-hmm.
about my own district right now. You know, I'm in Missouri, too,
yeah.
that I live in. And, you know, Ann Wagner,
mm-hmm.
it's like she really
mm-hmm.
doesn't really do anything. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you'll see a lot of people complaining about her even, you know, the fact that she
mm-hmm.
doesn't do town halls and doesn't do anything. But she just keeps winning, you know, each time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because there are a lot of people, there are people that vote, you know, and they're voting, and I'm thankful they're voting.
Mm-hmm.
But they just aren't paying that close of attention, you know. And
mm-hmm.
there are people, You know, I sort of look at it as levels, right? It's like mm-hmm. you can have people that are very, very politically astute, but, like, they don't really know the judicial candidates, which is understandable because a lot of us don't, right? So they'll just go in and they'll start being like, I'll pick names I recognize. But, like, I was telling my brother this the other day, I said, there are a lot of people that do that even at the congressional and Senate level, you know?
Yeah.
They come in to vote for a presidential candidate, but they don't necessarily know anything below the top of the ticket, you know? And this is especially true at the state legislative level. So in those situations, the power of the incumbency is huge. The power of name recognition is huge.
It's very true.
And, you know, those are the complicating factors.
Yeah.
I want to add on a question.
Go ahead.
I want to add on a question. You talk about judiciary, people running for the judiciary on state level and people not knowing, you know, what to stand for. Speaking of the Supreme Court of the United States, do you think that the seats should be expanded from 9 to 15 seats? And do you think there should be a term limit for Supreme Court justices?
Okay, so I'll take the second part first. I do think there should be term limits. I think I absolutely do. You know, as far as increasing it... It's one of those things that I think people are going to have a royal fit if you do, you know, obviously. But it, the fact is, it's been done before. And I think that the argument for doing it is pretty strong in the sense that the Republicans, you know, particularly Mitch McConnell, I mean, he made very calculated decisions here to essentially stack the court. I mean, they have stacked the court, you know? And so we can continue on here and just say, okay, well, they played slick and dirty and they stacked the court, and now the whole country has to, you know, just suffer and take whatever this stacked court has to say. The problem is it's an extremely partisan court, and it is not meant to be. And maybe in these extremely partisan times, it can't be truly nonpartisan, but it certainly can be leveled out to be more equal. And I think that there is a real argument to be made for that, because otherwise, too many Americans are not being represented. I mean, they simply are not.
No.
You know, and that is a problem. You know, small fun fact. I actually am related to John Marshall, who was, you know, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court way back early on. And I have gone back and read through so much that he's written, and I thought, he would freak out if he saw the court today. I mean, he really would. Because his whole thing was about the independence of the judiciary and about it staying out of, you know, partisan politics. And that's all it is now. And they don't even, you know, you have people like Clarence Thomas, they don't even try to hide it.
No, that's scary, isn't it?
And what's happened and what's truly sad is that people have lost respect for the courts. You know, and I don't know how we're supposed to operate with people not having respect for the highest court in the country. So, yes, I think that we have to look at how we rectify this. And I think that that may be how we do it, is that we add the seats and we say, well, we're going to even it out again. You know, you guys made this move, you stacked it, now we have to even it out, you know.
The only solution in my eyes.
Because it can't keep going on the way it is.
No. No. All the things that they're, you know, they're bringing up to the court are just not going to, you know, they're not going to stand. It's all partisan politics, and it's just not right, you know.
Well, that's also, there's some pretty dangerous decision making that they've made. You know what I mean? Like, you know, obviously the, you know, issue with Roe v. Wade, but more than that, it was that they were undermining the 14th Amendment with that. And, you know, going after laws based on it. There are a lot of other laws that hinge on that same ruling. So that could be very dangerous. I mean, and you can't get comfortable and think, oh, they won't go after it. You know, they could essentially go, they could go after interracial marriage if they wanted to. You know, I mean, they could go after contraception if they wanted to.
You're absolutely right. So my next question is, will America ever be ready for a woman POTUS?
You know, I have to believe so, right?
I hope so.
I feel like we have to, I mean, that we will get there, but I also am not surprised that we hadn't yet. I mean, well, don't get me wrong. I was surprised Hillary didn't win, but like, I wasn't surprised, you know, like if we rewind the clock back, you know, and you, and I go back to my younger years, I remember having a conversation with somebody, I think back when I was in college, about, they said that they thought we would have a woman president before a black male as president. And I said, no, I think we'll have a black male as president before a woman, you know. And it's, you know, and it's for a lot of reasons. I think that women, when they run for office, especially president, just right out of the gate, they have it very difficult because men and women aren't judged by the same things, no matter how much we try to say they are. It's like the criticisms I would hear about the female candidates would just boggle my mind.
I know.
You know, like criticisms about their voice, about their tone, about their behavior. You know, somebody, I remember somebody saying, oh, they don't like this candidate because, you know, they don't like Elizabeth Warren because she reminds them of their whiny liberal aunt, or they don't like, you know, I mean, it's odd, odd statements that have nothing to do with who somebody is or what their record is. And I don't, you know, I don't know how we overcome that per se, other than calling it out, you know, you know, and
I would
force people to. What's that?
Or like Hillary's pantsuits. Like Hillary's pantsuits, for example.
Which is
ridiculous.
That's a perfect example. I mean, you know, it's just an absolutely sort of ridiculous thing. I remember, I don't know if you recall this, but it was early in the campaign, and there was an article that came out talking about how Klobuchar was a mean boss. And there was this whole thing. And, like, my parents, who are Democrats, like, they read this. And then my – I remember my dad saying that my mom, well, she just doesn't like Amy Klobuchar for some reason. I think she said that she's a mean boss. I'm like, do you even know kind of how weird it is to base something on that? Because, first of all, nobody calls a male boss a mean boss like that way.
No.
Like, nobody would say the same criticism. I'm like, you can't lean into it. You know, you can't, like, reward these sort of odd things by buying into it, you know?
Yeah,
so
I
do believe we will get there. I just don't know if it's going to be as soon as we hoped.
And hopefully it won't be a Republican, like a Sarah Palin type, because that would be the end of the Republic.
Or you know, I was thinking today, I wonder if Liz Cheney is going to run.
You know, all I have heard about that is that she might run as a spoiler to Trump. You know, I think that she knows, I mean, she knows it wouldn't be a very viable candidacy because the same reason I can't, you know, with Pence, it's the same problem is Trump turned too many voters already against, you know, certain people. I think that if she did, she would do it to try to take Trump on directly. You know what I mean? To keep the conversation focused for longer on his actions. January 6th and all that. And, you know, I wouldn't blame her for doing it, honestly. I think the female Republican I would be the most concerned about running is Nikki Haley. You know,
the former UN ambassador.
She has carefully, she's been stepping very carefully, you know, enough to raise my eyebrows that she's thinking about it. You know, she manages to kind of get in there and play both sides and, you know, she's supporting Trump. You know, she chastises him here and there. But at any minute, she could step out and take him on, I think.
Yeah, because the interesting thing about Nikki Haley also, before she got UN ambassadorship representing the United States, she was governor of South Carolina for two terms, and you know, she got her political roots there in South Carolina, so she had the balls for politics.
Oh yeah, and so, she ran, and she was able to win a statewide race, which is you know, a pretty decent stepping, you know, background to step off of there.
Exactly. So tell me, Rachel, what are your thoughts on closing that revolving door on Capitol Hill? An elected official in the House or U.S. Senate gets defeated or chooses to retire. Then he or she goes to work for a wealthy special interest lobby group on Capitol Hill. Do you consider that a conflict of interest, and should the revolving door be closed permanently?
You know, I think ideally, you know, I think we all want to make sure that we're staying on the right side of ethics. And the concern, obviously, is that is there a point at which somebody is starting to audition for a lobbying position while they're still in office? I'm not mentioning any names, Kristen Sinema, but, you know, sometimes we see that. Where it looks like somebody is starting to obviously look for what their career will be after. At the same time, you know, running for office, you know, as somebody that gets involved in and like trying to recruit people to run for office, it's, you know, it's not always an attractive thing, you know, and less people seem to want to do it. You know, and I do worry that if we, you know, strap it with too many things, you know, or make it too controlling, that can be a turnoff. But at the same time, something like lobbying could potentially be a conflict. I mean, it isn't necessarily, but it definitely could potentially be. You know, if, as I said, you were either already starting to look towards that job and your decisions reflected that, or also afterwards you're using your relationships that you have to sway minds. So I don't think it is out of bounds to say that it is inappropriate, but I'm not sure how you make that happen exactly. You know, I'm not sure how you make a rule that controls what somebody does after a job.
Yeah.
You know, it couldn't, you know, and I don't know, you know, maybe smart, you know, but other people up with theories of that case.
Yeah, because what people see on both sides, whether Democrat or Republican, is that, you know, these lobbyists and special interest groups write these laws, and some of these congresspeople and senators don't read what's in these bills, but because these lobbyists and special interests pumping money in their re-election campaigns, they say, oh, okay, yes, yeah, so you give them $1 million, so sure, and I read the bill, that's where we vote on it. That's why we need somebody like Bernie Sanders in there, and then the other independent senator, Angus King, who read every bill that come to be voted on in the U.S. Senate floor, because special interests, like the big oil companies, big pharma, they write these laws, and the politicians just, like, vote for them. Why? Because they give them money on both sides. I guess it comes down to personal integrity.
I think it does. I also think that, I think that there should be some laws that are put into place to limit the lobbying industry. No doubt about that. I think that there's a lot of things that actually could be done from that angle of it. I was just saying, I think it might be difficult to make any kind of a legal demand on what somebody does after they leave a job. You know what I mean? If you take this job as a U.S. senator, you are not allowed to take a lobbying job after. You know, and maybe that's fine. Maybe you can do that. But there's part of me that thinks, you know, that might be something that's not constitutional in some way, you know, to say that.
Or how about this? Wait 10 years before, you know, being a lobbyist yourself.
It could be a matter of a contract that's signed, you know, and you could, you know, like some kind of contract that people are asked to sign when they take office. You know, like I said, I don't think you could make a real law about it, but I certainly think that there could be fines associated with it through ethics department, you know, the Office of Ethics and things like that. And the lobbying industry does need to be pulled back. There's no doubt about that. I mean,
it sure does.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
It has gotten ridiculous and out of hand. Absolutely. My next question is, do you think that Roe v. Wade will ever be the law of the land, you know, once again, protecting women's rights to choose and our health rights and health rights?
You know, that I think that if we have the votes to pass it at the federal level, we will, you know, do that. But I am not sure that that would stand up very well, because my fear is that the states then sue, and the Supreme Court has already said it goes to the states, you know. And so that's, and which is just sort of a testament to, you know, how serious the courts are, you know, what a serious issue it is. So I think that it would be possible that down the road, if we were to even the court out, or, you know, after this whole generation of court appointees is replaced way down the road, they may revisit it. You know, and they may change that Dobbs decision. But it's a bigger deal than people think. I mean, I saw a lot of stuff on, you know, like on social media following it, and a lot of people saying, why don't they just, you know, legislate it into federal law? And I kept thinking, I don't think that'll work out the way people think it will, though. Because once the Supreme Court has said it goes to the states, then the state would just sue, you know, and I don't know. I mean, granted, it would, you know, it could become a legal battle that keeps winding around, but in the end, as long as that Dobbs decision stands, I think it's a pretty big deal. And I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I you know, I could be wrong on that, but that's my impression. But do I think it's possible that it'll come back?
Earlier you said that there should be term limits for justices on the Supreme Court. Do you think? Yeah, do you think there should be also a recall mechanism for when they go in front of the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate for the confirmation hearings, and when they're asked questions and they bold-faced lied, like Gorsuch did, like Amy Coney Barrett did? You know, do you think there should be a recall system set up?
You know, I do, and I've even wondered, you know, a recall system or an impeachment process of some kind, you know, over that.
Mm-hmm.
I've also, I'll take that a step further, that not even just with the Supreme Court, but some of these federal appointees, you know, that, you know, your federal appointees that you have just consistently made, like, these terrible decisions that, you know, like, end up getting thrown out on appeal anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and they're clearly very partisan, you know, very partisan appointees. That, you know, I had asked this question of a lawyer not that long ago. I'm like, does anything happen to a judge if they just keep getting rulings wrong? Like, they keep making rulings that keep getting overturned.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, no, I mean, it doesn't matter. And I'm thinking, I feel like it should matter. You know, I feel like if somebody keeps making obviously partisan rulings that get overturned as unconstitutional, that should matter and be grounds for recalling them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yes, I do think there has to be a process. And I don't know what it is about the founders that they seem to have such belief in and the sort of greatness of these justices that there would be no need to not have a lifetime appointment or no need to recall them in any way. And I find that surprising because, you know, I think that they overlooked the fact that you could just get a bad egg in there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they probably stirred their minds, you know. They just probably never did.
You know, because Clarence Thomas is a bad egg, for example. You know, he should be recalled because of the whole thing with his wife, Janet Thomas, and the Trump administration, and Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of Trump, you know, and Giuliani. Yeah. You know, she was praising him through the text messages that came out recently saying that he's her hero. I mean, as the wife of a Supreme Court justice, she has no business in meddling with the transfer of power.
No.
That's crazy. You know? Yeah, okay, so my next question. You know, Gen Z and millennials make up almost 22% of our population. How will you target these Gen Zs and millennials so they'll vote Democrat?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I have great faith in Gen Z. And, you know, maybe I'm somewhat biased because of my children. But, you know, I really do. They're a very aware generation, you know. They're maybe because they've been completely reared on social media, they're a lot more versed in politics earlier than most of us
are.
You know, I believe they care about a lot of issues deeply, and I think that we get them by meeting them on their ground with the issues they care about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very concerned about climate change, obviously. They're concerned about mental health. You know what I mean? They're not... They don't have a lot of the same they have a different set of issues, you know, while and of course that's not true across the board. I mean, you know, sure, you've got conservative Gen Zs too, but a lot of them are just doing what their parents kind of think. You know, I see that play out all the time. I think I think you meet them where they are. I think, you know, reaching out to student organizations is very important. You know, doing things in the community that specifically reach out to high school and college students, I think are very important. I actually have an idea that I would love to see happen, is that I think that we should have a, that we should lower the voting age to 17, and that we should have a civics course that goes along with voter registration.
Oh, yeah.
That's similar to like driver's ed and getting your license. You know,
yeah.
And so that you would register, you know, go ahead and they take this course, they, you know, learn about civics, they learn how to research candidates, they learn how government works, they, you know, learn how to vote, learn all the rules of their state, all that. They automatically get voter, you know, registered to vote, and then they have their first election, you know.
That would be.
And I think that it would ensure that we're having an electorate that is sort of predisposed to civic involvement, you know, because we have a lot of people that have a lot of ignorance about civics and a lot of people that aren't invested at all, you know. Some people because they feel nobody's ever reached out to them. You know, even though we do try for that not to be the case, but.
Well, you know, if their family isn't interested at all, and if they don't vote, then they were, you know, they're not rich in that environment, then, you know, honestly, they're not going to, you know, get involved or be involved or even care.
Right.
So I like that idea very much. I think that would be a great idea. I really do.
I have a thought. Oh, sorry, Laura. I didn't mean to cut you.
That's okay. I just said, you know, how we could make it happen. You know, that would be something I think very ideal. I think that's
something that would have to be done. You know, I don't really know. I mean, I feel like it would probably have to be done at the state level. You know, but because states essentially write their own election law. You know, but I don't know. You know, I don't know. At the very least, I mean, you could still do it. You could still do it with the voting age being 18. But, you know, just because of the way kids' birthdays and ages are and stuff, it wouldn't guarantee that everybody went through the process.
Exactly.
You know, whereas I feel like if you did it, if we lowered it to 17, it would.
I like the 17
idea. My follow-up question is, in Australia, they have voting, and voting is on a national holiday. Do you think that would work in the United States where, you know, you have no excuses to register and vote because it's a national holiday every 4 years or 2 years on a particular day?
Should be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it absolutely should be a national holiday, and I think it's a very real choice that it's not. You know, I think that if we were to make a move to make it a national holiday, because, I mean, it's been brought up a lot, you know. I think that the Republicans will consistently fight it tooth and nail. You know, I mean, we're pretty much in a state of constant war between trying to make voting as easy and accessible to as many people as possible, and then the Republicans trying to suppress as many people as possible. So, I really don't like saying blatant things like that, but that's true. I mean,
but
they don't want people to vote because they're in a minority, and the more people vote, they know they'll lose.
Yep. Absolutely. When Democrats vote, we win. That's how it works. You know,
that is how it works.
That's the whole idea. Yeah, one last thing I wanted to bring up about Gen Z and millennials. They also care about gun control. You know, they
Absolutely.
Also care about. And I think those are probably the top three things, the environment, gun control, and you mentioned, what was the other one? Oh, mental health. and mental health. Absolutely. And I think those three things are really important to them. Mental health issues for that generation is very, how do I say, there's a lot of issues that go on because of the way the world is right now. And a lot of pressures.
All of these things enter play too, right? I mean, these kids, like we wonder why they have mental health issues. Well, they've been having intruder drills and gun drills since they were little, you know, very little. They worry they're going to be murdered at school.
Yeah.
You know, they worry that the world is going to burn up around them.
Yeah.
You know, they see natural disasters. They see, and also, because of the internet, they're exposed to so much more pain of the world.
Yes, they
are. And you can't shelter them from it.
No.
I mean, like, there's nothing you can do about the sheer amount of information they're exposed to at a very early age. And, of course, this is going to take a toll. Of course it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of mental health, you know, the LGBTQ community go through a lot, you know, with the pronouns and what have you, and right-wingers especially, you know, chastise them and degrade them, you know, and, you know, a 14, 15-year-old, you know, may, you know, say, oh, I'm gay, but they're afraid to come out because the repercussions from the parents, from people that they go to school with, they may get beaten up, you know. So we would really need to, you know, focus on LGBTQ youth and LGBTQ rights, as well as women's rights and immigration rights and what have you, and be exclusive as a party, or inclusive as a party, and help these groups.
Yeah.
Are Republicans okay?
Well, absolutely. And I think that this is an argument. I mean, this comes into, you know, going back to being the big tent, you know, and everything, is that there are factions, you know, within the party that, you know, they'll become frustrated with, you know, the way the messaging is gone, the way elections gone and stuff. And I will occasionally have people say to me, We need to stop talking about all the identity stuff, and we need to just talk about the you know, we need to focus on an economic issue, you know, an economic message, and not do the identity stuff. And I'm always like, we don't ever not do the identity stuff, okay? Because that is, because for one thing, you can't have one without the other. You can't have economic justice without inclusivity and diversity and general respect for each other. I mean, if, you know, people, in order for there to be an equal playing field, the identity factors, you know, the what people want to disregard as identity politics, it's critical to it. You know, people, you can't say, I'm not going to stick up for this group because they're a liability to us because of the culture wars, you know? And that's what I do see happen sometimes. You know, people are like, we're losing people because, you know, we're defending trans people. You know, well, I think that somehow maybe the message is getting disjointed in that, but you know, it only is construed as a negative if you allow the opposition to make it a negative. You know, what we're talking about is just, is there being acceptance of all people, that people have the right to live their life and to feel that they have equal access and equal protection under the law. That's it, you know. And if we don't stand up for everybody, if we don't continue to do that even when it's uncomfortable, you know, then we're not doing what we need to be doing.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. You know, and diversity is really important. I mean, it's what we are in this country. We are diverse people, and we can't turn our backs on that. There's no going back from that, and we have to continue on, you know, step forward and keep going. I don't see.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't see us going backwards in that respect.
It would be right. And, you know, and that's the thing, you know, and you could say that about so many different things, but it's like, you can't put a genie back in a bottle, right? Because it would be even worse, you know, like, I was talking about this with somebody recently. I said, imagine, and this goes back to, you know, what I was saying about the risks of the Dobbs decision and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what if they did turn around? And, you know, luckily we did just pass this legislation, but this was before that. Is that, you know, what if they did turn around and all of a sudden say gay marriage isn't legal anymore? And not only that, but Lawrence is gone too. You know, not only that, but we're going to let the sodomy laws come back. You know, we're going to...
Mm-hmm.
We're going to say you can't be gay anymore. I'm like, do you know how dangerous that would be, because so many people are already out?
And not only that, you know, there would be so many suicides and depression and anxiety.
Oh, my God.
Our society would be upside down.
Exactly. I mean, like, you can't all of a sudden, like, you know, it would be positively dystopian, you know, because you would have people, you know, your gay neighbors would suddenly be public enemy number one. I mean, it's not possible to do things like that. But that's that sort of weird, disjointed thinking that people have, you know, like they sit there and think, I don't like gay people, so I want them to be illegal. Well, that's an absurd idea. It's an absurd idea. You know,
I think it was Barry... Oh, sorry, go ahead. I'm going to point afterwards.
Fine.
Oh, no, well, Barry Goldwater in 1964, when he lost against LBJ, he did say that the religious right, you know, will be a problem for the Republican Party. And, you know, the religious right, the quote-unquote moral majority, is the problem because they don't know or don't want to accept the separation of church and state. It's in the Constitution of the United States where, you know, you're allowed to practice your own religion or be religionless, but they want to bring, religion in politics. And it never makes, you can ask people in Iran, Pakistan, you know, whichever Middle East country. If it comes to America, which they're trying very hard to do, then the gay community and others who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants will get, like, you know, the shaft, basically. You know, so that's my point.
You're actually right about that. Is that... you know, there are a frightening amount of people, I think, in this country that would be absolutely fine with it being a theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
that's
scary. That's disturbing. And those are the people, actually, that are the radicals, right? I mean, like, they'll sit there and they'll talk about the radical left or, you know, stuff like that, but... it's actually they who are the radicals, because they're the ones that actually want to turn the Constitution on its head. You know, they're the ones that want to say, no, I am perfectly fine with forcing everyone to live according to the rules of my religion. Well, that's not a government. That's a theocracy. And that's an autocracy. So, you know, I don't really know, you know, I don't feel like we should have ever been giving credence to those people. And I think that the media did for a long time, you know, going to, you know, junior high and high school through the 80s, you know, that was a constant term you would hear, the religious right,
mm-hmm.
you know, as, and the moral majority and all of that kind of stuff. And there mm-hmm. was sort of this legitimacy to that. You know what I mean? That this was a legitimate voting, you know, block that
mm-hmm.
had a legitimate pull on what would happen in this country. And it wasn't until I was older, you know, like really got in college and kind of looked at it that I thought, well, why? I mean, why are we looking to them to even have a say here? Because
mm-hmm.
we do have separation of church and state. It's
yes.
not, mm-hmm. you know, I don't begrudge anybody their religious beliefs. You know, I mean, it's a very
that.
Personal thing, you
yes,
know,
it is.
But you can't force people to adhere to yours, you know, and I feel like
no.
that's very basic, but yet here
yes.
we are, you know.
Yeah, I know. Here we are is right. Talking about things that were settled always, you know, as long as we can
well,
remember.
Well, that's the thing is that this
you know,
is
they're
pretty
digging up,
clearly
you know,
laid out.
Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying. You know, things are being dug up that were, you know, settled and put to rest, you know, so we could move on.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's true. So, you know, when people talk about, you know, like you talk about something like The Handmaid's Tale, you know, and there
yeah.
are a lot of people that bristle at that because they say, oh, that's, you know, hyperbole anyway. You know, that's extreme. That wouldn't happen. It's
mm-hmm.
like, wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah.
because if certain people had their way, it absolutely would happen like that.
Yes. There are
you
certain
know,
people
if certain people had their way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've done horrendous things in the name of religion over the course of humanity.
Of
you
course.
Know? Yep. So I,
sure.
you know, I have very little mm-hmm. doubt of how ugly it could get.
Mm-hmm. You better believe
oh,
it.
Yeah. The Catholic Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm sorry, I jumped in. It's
Madeline.
Oh, hello, Madeline. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Rachel Murphy-Zara, or you'd rather listen?
Well, I was actually wanting to just brava for hitting it the nail right on the head. The
mm-hmm.
forcing
mm-hmm.
of is that white Anglo-Saxon attitude. Benevolent from the past, that's where the colonists, their mindset, and they do not want to let go of their power that they think they have to allow people
mm-hmm.
to be who they are. They have the,
right.
they set the rules, and people have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Then they miss out
mm-hmm.
as to what democracy really is, human
exactly.
and how to do human beings. So that's my input to your conversation because
mm-hmm.
they don't want to let go. That is just, that's it right there. They want to
mm-hmm.
change people to be their way. Look at what's going on in Congress. Look what happened today, January 6th. They
mm-hmm.
put it all on the table and said, people, if you can't see this, we are in trouble.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did lay it out pretty cool. Pretty clearly
they
today.
Did, and you know what?
They
now is the true test.
Yeah, they didn't mess around today.
Mm-hmm.
They did not mess around.
No.
Well,
I think that each one of those charges was justifiable.
Oh yes.
Again, that white Anglo-Saxon, and in Trump's case, German, which a lot of theocracies
yeah.
that culture that.
Mm-hmm.
language, that belief, that religion has
mm-hmm.
affected and stuck to Fred Trump and passed down to you know who.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
we have a lot of I keep going back to Anglo-Saxon, but you know what? It's a shame that I am because basically that's where it's all coming from. They don't want to let go of that power, whether it's for religion, whether it's for state. Dave, what could we do? I mean, how do you think that mindset could change?
You know, I think that sometimes it's, there is this pattern, you know, of people voting against their own interests or even thinking against their own interests. Mm-hmm. And I find you get this a lot. I mean, especially with like rural white people and things like that, to where, and, you know, on the one hand, you have the fact that the Republican Party has really built up grievance politics so much. I mean, like they're always like, oh, you got to blame somebody. You got to blame somebody. And guess what? Blame this brown person. You know, blame this person. And that's what's going to happen.
That's the policy platform.
But then there's so much disjointed thinking with it. Like, you know, like one that completely puzzles me is we have a labor shortage going on, right? I mean, like, I'm sure everybody's noticed it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you try to go through a drive-through, nobody's working, places are shut down. There's a labor shortage. A lot of people were... You know, and there's a lot of reasons for that labor shortage. You know, it's not just any one reason, but, you know, particularly in the service industry, because places shut down, people went and they found other jobs. You know, they got jobs doing other things, and they're not working service anymore. Well, at the same time, we have all of these asylum seekers coming in, and everybody's complaining about them. We got to do something about this. We got to do something about this. Well, I'll tell you what to do about it. Get down there and process people and get them their work permits. You know?
Exactly.
Because we need
the
work.
Get them
and
they work.
And you know what? And you know what? That will help solve inflation. Because suddenly you don't have all these huge supply chain issues going on because you've got more workers. Everything's operating better. You know, you don't have anybody to work the docks. Guess who can work the docks?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, there, if you don't have
And they're
people,
willing. So willing.
We need people. And it is absolutely absurd to me.
Well,
the people
you know
that
what? That goes back to Governor. That goes back to Governor Abbott right there.
Yeah. Well, it isn't just Governor Abbott.
That's his mismanagement of that complete state. It's not as if he did not realize that this was coming. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you as an individual, an intelligent human being, you see a problem coming. Are you going to be reactive or proactive? I mean, why were you not having some type of facilities temporarily set up? You would need to get some health checks. Get a processing process. We're the United States of America. I'm so tired of hearing of all the excuses and complaints in the Republican Party because I haven't heard one intelligent platform yet.
Well, they very rarely have anything to offer is the problem. They offer complaints, but they don't offer solutions. And, you know, as we turn the page into yet another election cycle, you know, that's something that I remind everybody to do, you know, is when people are when you're talking to voters, remind them of that. It's like, what is it that they've offered? What is their solution? Because I don't hear any solutions to any of this. Just complaining.
Wait till title.
I have the next one. Okay, we're going to go to the next question. We have another question for you, Rachel. Should the filibuster be abolished?
Okay, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I think what we need to do is a carve-out for voting rights. I mean, that's honestly, you know, and I can tell you, like, some of the conversations I've had about this with other people, you know, my initial squeamishness about getting rid of the filibuster is that we've certainly been in the minority before, and the filibuster has come through when we needed it, you know. I have very real fears about it starting a sort of even worse boomerang cycle than we already have, you know, where it makes it almost impossible to govern long, you know, in any way, because every time something will get passed, they'll just, vote the next party in, and they'll, you know, tear it down, and they'll do some extreme thing, and then, you know, all of this, I worry about that. Now,
you do have a point there.
The flip side is that, hey, you know, they're going to do these extreme crazy things anyway, so, you know, that's what I have people say to me. It's like, they're going to do this anyway, so, you know, we might as well get rid of the filibuster and just do what we can now. And obviously there's a lot of concern about democracy. There's a lot of concern about what they could potentially do if they could, you know, have a successful coup this time and there'd be no going back. And these are all valid things. And the only thing I can think of would be to do a carve out that specifically focuses in on, you know, the Electoral Count Act and, you know, we had the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, you know, that would specifically get in there and shores up election law and shores up democracy. You know, it'd be, and, you know, gets some money out of politics. You know, all of these things that were put in.
Yeah, all the little things,
right, that we could sort of get in and get done, but still preserve at least partially, you know, some sort of protection for the minority, which is what the filibuster does provide, you know, or at least keeps it from having, you know, having too much of sort of a crazy, you know, a crazy group within the party take control. I mean, like, I'm sitting here looking at some of the whack jobs in the Republican Party and thinking, I can come up with some nightmare scenarios they might do without a filibuster, you know.
You're right. You do have a point. I have to agree. I like the carve-out idea a lot. If they could fix some things, that would be great. Because there are things that need to be fixed.
There are. There are things that need to be fixed. And I feel like the threats to democracy are, you know, that's crucial. I mean, that's critical that we do something about it. But I'm very, I am very personally uneasy with the idea of just saying, hey, we're not going to have a filibuster anymore. You know, and if all of a sudden every crazy idea that the Republicans want to pass with 51 votes, I mean, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and it makes sense. Yes, I do understand. I guess for my last question, I think, are you planning on staying until 11? What was your plan, Rachel?
I'm an hour earlier than you, so you threw me when you said that. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. Yeah, Missouri. I forgot.
Yeah.
So it would be 10 there. Okay. I guess what I'm going to ask you is, what inspired you to get involved in Missouri politics?
Well, you know, we actually, actually my group is national, you know, I do national politics. So we're not specifically focused on Missouri, although I do live here. What inspired me to, I think I addressed a little bit at the beginning, was that maybe it's sort of the easiest way to be it without being cliche is sort of be the change you seek, you know. You know, I was looking at things that were not going in the trending in the right direction. You know, we had been losing seats as a party. Obviously, Trump won, which was one of the most shocking moments of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, I remember, you know, that next day, and I'm looking at these two kids, you know, the kids were little, and I'm like, I can't hand them this world, you know, without doing everything I can to try to make it better for them. Like, I just have to feel like I'm doing something to make it better.
And at least you tried, you know?
Right.
So I feel.
And so I just decided, you know what? I'm going to do what I've been doing, which is organizing, but we're going to organize at a higher level than we've been doing. You know, let's actually form an organization. Let's actually do this. So I guess that's where that came from.
Well, that's great. I love that. And I'm so happy that you're doing that. And we hope to continue our relationship and, you know, so that we can work together for our 2024, you know, election, because we need to win for sure.
My last question before you go.
Okay.
My last question before you go. Would you ever run for political office at any level?
You know what? I certainly thought about it. I think if I did it, it would probably be down the road, even though I'm not exactly a spring chicken now. But the thing that's kept me from running for office is just personal family commitments. You know, my children were young. I have a special needs son. You know, I have family members that have health problems. That it was just like, if I, like in Missouri, I live in St. Louis, and actually the seat of government is in Jefferson City, you know. So any, you know, I would have to travel back and forth. And, you know, so obviously, you know, for higher office, you know, it's D.C. So logistically was problematic. But who knows, you know, maybe 5-6 years down the road, maybe I would consider it.
And it, you know, the other thing is the cost of a campaign, you know.
That's
the other problem. You know, it's in millions now, isn't it?
The right conversation with the right people, exactly. With great marketing skills.
And again, is where the special interests come in again, where, you know, this, whatever unions there is or whatever big corporation is, okay, what can you do for me? It's not what can you do for the people, but me and my organization. So if we get big money out of politics, then, you know, we're off to a good start. Because look at Great Britain, for example. When they have an election, it lasts 6 weeks tops. You know, there's a campaign limit to both parties or all parties involved, and you cannot go over that limit, and corporations can't give to these parties. We shouldn't have that in America, because what happened in America, rich individuals donating, you know, corporations, and, you know, just buy the candidates. And that's not right, because, you know, what about we the people, the regular Joe who worked a 9-to-5 job, or some single mother with four children, you know, working three jobs? You know, we need to go back to basics and represent the people who elected us.
Yeah, that's not their objective anymore, though, if you notice in the Republican Party. They want that salary. They want those benefits. They get an office. They get a staff. Luckily, they get a car, a driver. Why in the world would they not, once they get voted in, work on the next campaign? Because that is exactly what each and every one of them, starting with Marjorie Taylor Greene. That is her objective, to stay in that seat. I haven't heard one of that.
Rachel, I don't know if you have to run now, but, you know, we took up a lot of your time, and we thank you very much for being on the show tonight and, you know, telling us about Democrats Work for America.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate
it. Maybe, you know, maybe Rachel, down the road, you can come back on.
Sure.
And we can talk some more and strategize. That would be awesome.
Sure, definitely.
We need help in Michigan, that's for sure.
That's what I'm hearing.
In my area, has been red for 20 years, and you know, we're trying here, but it's hard to break through that red here.
Well, you know what? We did good, Lori. We did. We have a blue.
No, we did good as far as we did well as far as the governor. you know, our Attorney General,
yeah.
Secretary of State, you know, our Supreme
yeah,
Court.
Senate.
I mean, that's all beautiful.
The House.
We took,
yes. It's all blue.
Yeah, the legislature. Yes, all of that. But I'm talking about, you know, where we live. It's red here, and it's a big area, and I would love to see that turn blue. That would be a dream come true.
Well, and, you know, some of the strategies that we really try to employ, you know, especially is we do a lot of sort of multi-directional strategies in the sense that, you know, if you, for instance, if you turn out voters on a specific region, that can spill over even across into multiple states, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also you want to do sort of longitudinal support, you know what I mean, or vertical strategies, you know, is that if we can get people, you know, like if you can, like we don't always do state-level support because we're only so big, right? But, like, every once in a while, you'll see us endorse a state-level candidate, and somebody might be like, why out of the blue did they endorse this state-level candidate? Mm-hmm. And it'll be because the strategy in that area will be, because if we can turn out voters for this state-level candidate, they're going to vote up the chain, right?
Yep.
Because bringing in voters for this state legislature is going to bring voters for that district member of Congress. It's going to bring voters for that Senate seat, you know? And so sometimes when we're really trying to mobilize a certain area, you know, you have to sort of drill down into and find those winnable candidates all the way down the line. And that's work that starts very early, you know? I always find it kind of difficult right now because it's you have an election end and everybody's sort of like nobody wants to hear about fundraising anymore, you know?
No.
But it's like for us, like our group, this early time is when we're doing our most intensive work because we're out there trying to identify those strategies and identify those candidates, you know, and sort of mass them to each district. So we kind of just barely turned the page and we're ready to go again.
Well, that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. I love it. Rachel, it was a pleasure to meet you. It was a pleasure to have you on the show. We will be talking again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay.
Yes,
bye-bye.
Bye. Yes, we're talking with Rachel Murphy-Zahra, Democrats Work for America is our organization. You can get them at democratsworkforamerica.org on their website. The vet candidates, you know, the background checks and candidates endorse candidates. Candidate vetting, targeted support in rural, suburban areas. Not only in Missouri, where she's from, but all across the country. They do the get-out-of-vote efforts with local groups and campaigns on a national support level. The mobilized volunteers. The big thing is electing Democrats to office up and down the ballot and ensure a strong bench and for the judges and increase the success of policy changes. As Rachel said, be the change you want to see. You know, and we hit on other topics today about you know the insurgency when with a woman the president of the United States. We'll hit on the Supreme Court. You know, we hit on the filibuster should be abolished. You know, some good things like that you know that people are thinking about. You know, so you know, democratsworkforamerica.org is the website. Please go there, support them, and see what they're about.
And
they're a good organization.
Yes, and David, I also believe that she is on. I don't know if you ever heard of Demcast, but she is also involved with Demcast. And they worked in the primary, and they did a lot of good work. So she's also involved in that. And they are a national organization as well. All good things. All good things.
Yes, yes. Oh, I want to thank Kelly from Michigan from calling in earlier. And also Susie. Susie not feeling well, so get well soon.
Of course.
And Okay, so ladies, you've been hearing the interview and all. What do you think, starting with Elaine?
Oh, I think I was very productive, very productive. The only thing that I guess I'm in a minority. I do not think that age has anything to do with running for office. If you are qualified, and that's what people have to start looking at, qualifications. An 18-year-old can be qualified, and an 80-year-old can be qualified. I am a firm believer that after the age of 50, you really do. I think you gain a lot more knowledge. All of a sudden, your thinking changes. And I think that you learn to maneuver better. It makes you a better politician after the age of 50. I think you learn how to maneuver. You maneuver around bad people, and you maneuver around situations. A lot of it has to do with life's experiences. And we have to explain that to people that are under 30. Life experience, just living every day and paying bills and going to work, life experience adds a lot to it. Because, y'all, just think back to when you were 30 and now. Haven't you learned a lot?
I agree. The experience, your life experience does mean a lot. It doesn't.
So I mean, I don't like to hear anybody dwell on age. That they're too old. They're too old. No, nobody's ever too old, and nobody's ever too young. I think we've got to quit dwelling on age. Other than that, it was a beautiful conversation. Loved it.
Yeah. I can't wait to work with. We're planning on working with her somehow. So yeah, it's going to be nice. And Elaine, have you ever heard of DemCast? Have you heard of DemCast?
Pardon?
Have you ever heard of DemCast, D-E-M-Cast? There is a DemCast. Have you ever heard of that? It's an organization as well. They worked on the primary, and so that's another great organization. And I think she's part of that as well. I'm pretty sure she is.
That's good because the Democrats for so long were just disorganized. So now we're organized.
Yeah, I think things are getting better. I really do.
I hope so. I'm waiting for my Christmas present. I'm waiting to see who in an orange jumpsuit.
Oh yeah.
Right. That was so good. Yeah. Madeline. It's a beautiful color for him. It goes well with his hair.
Yeah, that would be like the perfect Christmas, wouldn't it?
It would be.
I would take all my presents and give them away.
Oh, yeah. You better believe it.
Yes.
Me too. So I don't know about you, Elaine, but I think the fire is getting hot on his feet. Pretty hot. They're coming at him from all sides, so eventually somebody has to get him.
He seems to be semi-quiet. Not totally. He's not as boisterous as he was.
According to certain reports, he smashed his television and threw ketchup on his wife recently when the January 6th committee hearings was going on today, so... I mean, he's still losing his composure, and he's still the narcissistic fool that we all knew he was, but he's been less public about it, All we can hope is that he goes to prison where he belongs and spend 25 years or more, because what he did was narcissistic, was indecent. It was just gross. No president has ever done that before. How dare he?
Yeah.
Well, did you notice that the sentencing now, even for the insurrectionists, is going from 2 weeks to a couple months to 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's going to 5 years, 10 years.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So I think that that the dominoes are starting to get in place.
I think so too.
So, you just have to be patient.
We just have to, you know.
Did other people chime in on the program?
I'm sorry.
Did you have other states?
Other states?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
The reason I ask that is I keep sending, when you send me the notification, I keep sending it to other people, and I'm curious whether they're tuning in.
You have to ask David that. Because he's the one that
I mean, I look at the statistics like a day or two after the fact. And according to the statistics on Blog Talk Radio and even on Facebook, the listenership is rising weekly, which is a good thing. I mean, we don't have the Mike Malloy or Rush Limbaugh numbers. You know, that's a long way in going. You know, but
how about tonight's broadcast? Do you know if anybody from any other states tuned in?
I'm not sure. I'm not going to get the statistics till tomorrow. That's a thing.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm just curious. But, you know, I'll keep sending it. Sometimes it takes time.
Oh, yeah, Lane. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you know, and, you know, this time of year, people are very, you know, they're busy. It's Christmas time and, you know, everyone's doing their holiday thing. So, you know, we were grateful to have Rachel on, and she was awesome. I really think that her ideas are fantastic, and, you know, very happy about that.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. We'll take this last caller here, Pianke. Oh, yeah, you want to say something?
I'm fine.
Oh, yes, Pianke is calling in. Welcome, Pianke, to the show. Yeah, Pianke, welcome to Kitchen Politics. What's cooking tonight?
Well, I'm happy that we hear people talking about my great state of Missouri, red state that it is. And I was born and raised there. I happen to be close to a Democratic area that was Democrat for 72 years, St. Louis, and the politics there just totally messed up. But, of course, I'm down here in another red state, that of Louisiana, and I feel like I'm at home. I want to thank the Missouri State Legislature for passing school choice and also constitutional carry to an extent. I thank Mel Hancock for the bill he passed years ago, the Hancock Act, that required the state legislature to give back tax dollars when they was collected beyond the revenue that was needed to run the state. That way you don't have money in their hands to wastefully spend. But other than that, everything's pretty good.
So did you listen to the interview with Rachel Murphy Azaria earlier? And what do you take away from the interview that we had with her?
Well, I didn't hear it because I had a show that I've been invited to at 10:30. If they're going to have it, I hear snow is pretty bad where they are. But how did it go for you? Did you like what you heard?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know,
what were some of the strong points?
The strong points about term limits for the justices on the Supreme Court. That was a good thing. The recall back program when, you know, to impeach them, things like that.
Well, the Constitution don't stipulate term limits for chief justices. I think that each state should provide. It should be, but it don't. Now, if you want an amendment, that's a whole different story. You get 3/4 of the state. I support the I support the convention of states, and I think there should be 50 Supreme Court justices, one for each state. And we just got to figure out how to break that tie.
And we spoke about Gen Z millennials that make up 22% of the population, and how Democrats plan to target them, especially in rural areas. We spoke about Roe versus Wade. We spoke about, is America ready for a female president of the United States? Do you think in our lifetime that we'll ever have a female president of the United States? And if so, who?
I think Carrie Lake would make a good president.
Oh, my God. I knew you were going to say that. No, no. She's crazy. She's out of her mind.
Now, that's what I say about you Democrats. Let me say it.
Come on.
Democrats in St. Louis, Democrats in St. Louis have constantly, constantly made Democrats, for instance, the Democrats in the St. Louis area have constantly wanted to get people to come out and vote and tell them how to vote. That's what it is with the black community in St. Louis.
No, no, you have it wrong, Pianke. It's about how politics affect people. You know, it affect their pocketbook, it affect their health care, the education of their children, what Republicans trying to take away
the federal government has no
education.
Business. Federal government has no business getting involved in health care. Where in the Constitution does it call for that?
Oh, my Donna Santa, here we go.
Oh, he's back again.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He's back again.
So Missouri is a good state.
Okay.
And I've done a lot of building in the state of Missouri. And like I said, I've stayed there all my life. Love the St. Louis Cardinals. And what more can I say? And as far as I know, the Constitution doesn't dictate how long a Supreme Court justice should exist, but it says, but for good behavior. That's what it reads.
John. Yeah, but the thing is, my opinion, as well as Rachel Murphy Azaro, there should be term limits amended to the Constitution, because sometimes, you know, these judges get old and the mind goes.
Well, there's no age discrimination.
Scalia was one crazy person.
Age discrimination? Is what you're talking about? No.
No, I'm not saying
it's
age
like
discrimination.
People,
well, at some
well,
point.
You said they would get old. Well, here's the thing. There's ways to get your politicians out of office, and let's vote them out. And citizens should write the laws that they choose to be judged by. I should say ruled by. Politicians are dumb. The politician you voted for today, yesterday, he was just an auto mechanic. I mean, not saying wrong things about auto mechanic, but a lot of them don't know what the hell they're doing anyway. Look at your Stacey Abrams. Look how much money she has supporting her that came outside the state of Georgia and even outside the country. So who do you think she would have been behooving
no,
to if she was elected
outside
to Senate?
Of the country? No, that's illegal. You know, where's the evidence saying
George
she got
Soros?
Contributions
from- George Soros, although he say he lives, George Soros contribute to politicians and causes all the time. Look at FTX. That was coming from Ukraine.
No, man. George Soros is an American of Jewish descent. You know, he's not from outside.
George Soros is from Australia, which is a anti-Semite country known for. But what I'm saying is that outside money should not. But, you know, that will hopefully be changed. I mean, it's just.
John,
because
you believe in the Constitution. Why are you so against so many people?
Well, I'm against so many people.
Yeah, the Constitution.
I'm not against the people themselves. I'm against their policies.
So many people.
I'm against the policies.
You have such a bad attitude.
No, I have a lovely attitude. People write me letters and compliment me on them.
Mm-hmm.
You. The Constitution doesn't say anything about LGBTQ people, does it? Does it say that we're supposed to be mean to them? Why aren't people abiding by the Constitution and leaving them alone?
I don't have no problems with LGBTQ people and all the other.
I didn't accuse you.
Well,
I didn't say you.
Well, I'm telling you my position. I just don't want them teaching my kids.
You have been talking about what the Constitution dictates to the people. So I
it
am talking about
it
the
doesn't
people,
dictate
not
to the people.
You.
It provides protection. The Constitution protects you from the federal government. Your Bill of Rights protects you from the states.
Well, then why aren't people being protected Why are people being persecuted because they believe in a particular type of God?
Well, let me tell you something. Here's the thing where the protection stops. Like we just got revealed from Twitter's tweet, how you have ex-FBI employees working for Twitter, are working to do the best that they can to stifle free speech. Michelle Obama, they found a Twitter tweets from her where she's pressuring Twitter to shut up Donald Trump. You call that free speech?
Oh, my God. I don't know where you get your facts from. Where do you get your facts from?
You can read the tweet. Go to Twitter.
Oh, Twitter. I believe everything that's on Twitter.
It was a tweet that she submitted.
I will be a very smart twiddly D.
David, what's your email address?
David?
Ma'am, you sound like a child. Now, I'm pretty much sure you're older than me.
Man, I get in contact with you, Pianke, but, you know, we'll have to run now and everything because we're fast running out of time. So thank everybody for calling in, sharing, liking, supporting, subscribing.
You're running
whatever.
Out of time? Well, thank God for that.
Yes. We'll have
but
two,
anyway, yeah, contact me and I'll send you links to where you can read those tweaks yourself. You can read an article in the Washington Post, New York Times about the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Whatever.
All right, man.
And please
be
careful.
Everybody. Mm-hmm. Yes, man. Okay, so we're pleased to have Rachel Murphy-Azar, co-founder and executive director of Democrats Work for America, on the show tonight. We spoke about a lot of things. And, you know, she's
exactly.
a part of Demcast.com. And like I said, go to her website, democratsworkforamerica.org, and learn about these two groups. They're good groups. They're trying to spread a message what Democrats are about and the policies, you know, to help America move forward and everything. Okay, so Thursday coming up, we'll have another show, another interesting show. And in the near future, sometime in the new year, hopefully sooner than later, we hope to have Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, Democrat from Michigan, because she started this rural caucus to appeal to people in the rural areas across America, not just Michigan, you know, but in Missouri and Arkansas and wherever. Because in the last election, we saw that Donald Trump had 2/3 of rural votes. And we can cut him for that because if John Fetterman in Pennsylvania could do it, so can Democrats across the country.
You better believe it.
We can eat away at the monopoly of the Republicans with rural votes. It's very important that everybody is included.
You're right, David. Absolutely correct.
Yes.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. So any final thoughts, Laura, before we go?
No, it was a great show. I think it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
With Rachel. Happy
yes,
about
ma'am.
Everything.
All right, folks. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Kitchen Politics 123. It's December 19th, 2022. The interview was with Rachel Murphy-Azar, democratsworkforamerica.org. Check her out. Until next time, Thursday, same time, same place. This is David Franklin. Good night, Laurie.
Good night, David.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Have
See
a
you Thursday.
Night. Yeah. Thank you.
Michigan Thursday, 7:30, Mountain Time, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of Kitchen Politics 123. Good night, America.
I'm sorry, I'm a little late. You always try to